Well, welcome. You're listening to Near FM on 90.3. This is Cover to Cover, and I'm Joe Collins. Joining me in the studio is a resident reviewer, Michael Sharp. Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Hi, Joe.
Michael today is going to be reviewing Inside the GPO, a first-hand account. It's it was the memoirs of Joe Good, originally published in 1996, but he was an unlikely volunteer. He was born in Soho in 1895. They say his Irish heritage was uncertain, although he always felt Irish. But he had a sort of a strong socialist idealism, and he hated British imperialism, and this led him towards, along with his some chance meetings he had with the Gaelic League and Irish nationalist agitators in England, this led him, and his friendship with Michael Collins, this led him towards the Irish nationalist cause, and he did find himself going over to Ireland and actually join the Irish Volunteers. But he kept all this story to himself until his son Morris encouraged him to write down his memoirs, and they were originally published in 1986, but however they're republished ahead of next year's centenary rise, and it's his account inside the GPO. Well, Michael, how did it go down the book?
Fine, you know, as you said, it's a first-hand account, and in that sense it differs, and is useful that it differs from traditional historian's account. It's by a man who was there seeing it at first hand, rather like what nowadays be called embedded journalists, you know, who are in the war zone.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is a soldier actually fighting. As you said, Joe Good, he was English. He claims he has this Irish heritage, although his mother's name was Spencer, but
right,
this is never spelled out what exactly his connection with Ireland was.
Yeah.
But he certainly became interested in Ireland and Irish things. He joined the Irish Republican Brotherhood, as it was in London, apparently on the same day as Michael Collins.
Really?
And he became friendly with Michael Collins soon. Calls him Mick. Apparently, people who knew Michael Collins all, he was known as Mick.
So he
calls him Mick Collins throughout the book. But he joined on the same day, and then in 1916, he decided to come to Ireland to fight in the upcoming rebellion, which was being talked about.
Yeah.
Now, one of the motivations of that inevitably was that conscription was, of course, happening in England for the
British Army
for the First World War. And he was of an age, having been born in 1995, he was now 20, so he was going to fight. And he basically decided, well, if I'm going to fight, I'm going to fight in Dublin rather than in the trenches in Flanders or wherever. That was obviously a motivation as well. But he came to Dublin some months, I think, only before the actual rising.
Really, as early as that.
And got involved in, you know, looked up contacts, got involved in the Irish Republican Brotherhood here. And he talks a bit about the preparations for the rising. And it comes out how somewhat unprepared and amateurish, I suppose, is the word the whole thing was.
Yeah.
That he was based with a number of other, mainly, again, Londoners.
Is that the Kimmage lads?
The Kimmage, yeah. He was out in Kimmage. And they were mainly Londoners. And he describes him, you know, they were having to forge their own bayonets and bullets.
I mean, that was shocking, really. I mean, I know it was sort of haphazard, but goodness, making your own bayonets and bullets.
Yeah, well, there had been attempts to import guns from Germany, there had been the famous landing in Howth, which allegedly mirrored the landing up in Larne of
the
guns
UVF,
for the Ulster, for the UVF.
Yeah,
but in fact, what the UVF got was a very substantial amount of very usable
weapons.
Whereas the landing in Howth has been described as not a great deal more than a PR stunt in some ways. There wasn't a lot of, you know, the number of guns landed were not that significant, and a lot of them were old and not very usable.
Yeah, they say weapons. Some say that the Germans' attempt at landing guns was sort of half-hearted. They really weren't making a serious effort to supply arms to them.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, there have been suggestions that, I mean, Erskine Childers, who's, you know, master, the senior, Erskine Childers Senior, you know, whose son subsequently became a Fianna Fáil TD minister and president of Ireland, that Erskine Childers Senior was very much a member of the British establishment. He was, I think he was at that time a member of Parliament in Britain. And that, in fact, what happened in Dublin, by some accounts, was actually welcomed in London because it heightened the situation of the possibility of civil war in Ireland, which was being taken into account in terms of the possibility of the First World War. That one of the reasons why people said, England will never go, Britain will never, won't go to war in Europe, because they'll be too busy dealing with the situation in Ireland. And there's some element of support for that. I mean, historians have said that the position of John Redmond was key in the speeches he made committing Ireland to the Irish people, to the British cause in the army, was significant in allowing Britain to actually go into the First World War. That had that not happened, they would have been thought, well, we're going to have to look at our backs in Ireland. It was only when Redmond, at an early stage of the war, committed the Irish nation to supporting the war in England. Now, conscription never happened in Ireland, but Redmond seemed to be moving in that way. Of course,
but wasn't it Redmond? But he was keeping his eye on the Home Rule Bill, wasn't he?
Yeah, Redmond was the leader of the Irish Party in Parliament, so Redmond was the Home Rule Bill man, and he had succeeded in getting the Home Rule Bill. Had actually been passed in 1914. It was on the statute book. So, but then it was, and so Redmond sort of said, "Look, we'll be loyal, you know, once you."
Yeah.
But of course, the problem was, from the Irish point of view, that the Home Rule Bill was then suspended. They went to war, the Home Rule Bill was suspended.
It was never
brought in, and by the end of the war, 1916, it happened, and Redmond, having been the leader of a very strong Irish parliamentary party, now had no power, and the Irish Parliamentary Party was, of course, destroyed then by Sinn Féin in the election after the war.
Right.
So all this was happening. So, but to come back to the point that I was making, and which Joe Good describes, is that the preparations for the rising were fairly amateurish in many ways. And in fact, he admits that he and a lot of
yeah, he was
the people
aware
who
of
fought,
it, wasn't he?
That admit that they recognised at the outset that chances of success were slim, but they felt it was worth doing. Now, there were different motivations to it. I mean, Pierce had this theory of the blood sacrifice. Others had other views.
And there was such a strong military presence about Dublin at that time. I mean, they didn't have to send far for troops and ships.
Not at all. No.
To combat this,
they were
rebellion.
They were there, and of course they brought in support from Britain. I mean, which of course led to the famous Battle of Mount Street Bridge. One of the own areas where there was significant fighting outside the GPO was at Mount Street Bridge, when the British Army launched. They brought in a group of what we call Sherwood Foresters, who were a regiment in the army, and they landed in Dunleary, or Kingstown as it was, and marched in through Ball's Bridge. Got as far as Mount Street Bridge, and the rebels had ensconced themselves there on the town side of Mount Street Bridge, and they opened fire on them, and it was one of the main areas of where people were killed. I mean, the leader of the regiment was actually shot. Was one of the first people shot, and there's stories about him in the papers recently, that his wife and family had come to Ireland to get out of Britain during the war, out of England during the war,
right.
And he, unbeknownst to him, they were actually living in Dunleary when he, and when he landed, they got off the boat and they started marching through the town. The first person he saw was his wife and kids. And he went over and embraced them and then set off to march into Dublin, and an hour later was shot.
Was he killed?
Oh, he was killed.
My goodness.
He was shot and he was wounded, brought into a house, but he died.
Right.
But that's the story, as I say. Joe Good was born in Soho, 1895. The book was written from his memoirs. After he fought in the GPO and he subsequently fought in the War of Independence with Michael Collins. We'll come back to a few of the escapades that he got up to in that. And he then was completely disheartened by what happened immediately after the treaty with the Civil War, yeah, such that he actually left the army. But then when Collins was killed, he was persuaded and moved to come back in, and he fought on the pro-treaty side in the Civil War. But immediately it was over, he stood down again from the army and took no further part in it. He was completely disheartened by what happened in the Civil War and the splitting of the comrades, and how he saw his friends fighting against one another and being killed by other friends and so on.
And he's still he's a young man at this
stage. He basically retired. And where the book came from was then he married twice, in fact, but his first wife, with whom he had four children, was a London Irish woman as well.
Did he go back to London?
No, he never went back. He settled, he married, he had four children. He settled in Templeogue, beside the Dodder. He, I think, developed a gardening business. Not sure what he worked at. They mentioned that he developed a garden. Whether this was actually his full-time occupation, I'm not 100% sure. But he had four children, and he used to recount to some extent the events to the children, although he was quite reticent about
stories,
it.
Yeah.
But Morris, the son who was the big instigator in eventually writing the book, describes how, of course, children growing up in Dublin in the 20s and 30s, as they were, would be challenged by other kids at school. What did your dad do in 1916? And he used to delight in going into his father's stuff at home, because he knew he had medals and all this sort of thing, and bringing them in to show to other kids in the class. His father, he would persuade his father to talk a bit about the whole thing. And eventually he persuaded his father in about 1946 to actually start writing the whole thing down. And as you said, it was eventually published in book form by Brandon Brooks in 1996. And now has been brought out in 2015 by the O'Brien Press, presumably commemoration of the Rising in mind. The book, there's an introduction by Robert Balla, the artist, who has a Republican, very strong Republican sympathies as well. And he talks about Joe Good and the unique type of
character
account it is, and then goes on to how he exemplifies the ideas and the background of the 1916 rebellion, and hoping that the centenary will give a further impetus to really achieving the kind of cultural and national Ireland that was envisaged by people,
which most people would say have gone astray
over the last 100 years.
Yeah, Bala, I noticed that about Bala's introduction. He firmly affixes himself to the revolutionary.
Well, I mean, that's no secret. I mean, Robert Bala has been very much on that of that ilk.
And speaks
many times about 1916, and he's very much involved in Republican. Well, I don't know how much involved, but certainly a supporter of Republican activities.
Where does he sort of kick off from?
He kicks off, as I said, from describing how he was, his upbringing. Well, not his upbringing, but the early bits are about him being in London and his interest, as I said, in joining the Irish Republican Brotherhood and then coming to Dublin. And he describes the training insofar as that it was that they got in this. He was attached to this group in Kimmage, most of whom were from London. In fact, one of the surprising things, and Bala refers to it in his introduction as well, is how many Londoners there were actually in the GPO in 1916. But he joins the IRB. He has his training, and then on Easter Monday, he's among the group that is dispatched from Liberty Hall to take over the GPO.
The IRB, they were the
Irish Republican Brotherhood was the movement, and they were the armed wing of it. The title Sinn Féin had been there as well as a political party, but the Republican Brotherhood were the armed part of it. He is first posted not actually in the GPO, but on the corner of O'Connell Bridge. There was a sweet shop, and a few of the soldiers were sent to guard the approach on O'Connell Bridge by defending this sweet shop. And he describes being there with a couple of other friends armed defending. Then on the Wednesday of Easter week, by the time that they were becoming more and more under pressure, they were ordered to come back into the GPO. So then from then until the following, till the end of the rising, the next couple of days, he was actually in the GPO.
And how long were they actually in the
It was only a week. GPO. I mean, they were in the GPO. The Easter rising started on a Monday, and they pulled out of the GPO on the Thursday and surrendered on the Friday. I mean, it only lasted a week, in effect. And the main battles were on the early part of the week. And he describes quite very well that the withdrawal from the GPO and having to, what happened was, as is being highlighted now, because there's the debate about the future of the houses in Moore Street, which is...
That's right, yes.
Because what happened was they got out the side door of the GPO, crossed Henry Street and went back into the houses along Moore Street. And of course, Henry Street, they were under fire from the British Army.
They were making a break from the post office.
They had to make a break, and people were killed, as they crossed Henry Street.
Yeah.
And he describes this. And he describes the last hours in the post office and the debate about leaving and the debate about surrendering and so on. And he, although he is friendly with Michael Collins or Mick Collins, and he mentions various exchanges he had with him, he talks about the other leaders as... In passing, and he has contacts with them, but he doesn't sort of dwell on them to any great extent.
Does he mention the Pierce brothers at all?
Yeah, well, the only thing he talks about is that when they were leaving, well, not the only thing, but he mentions Pádraig Pearse, not the other brother, I don't think it's mentioned. But Pádraig, when they were about to leave, they were addressed by the leaders to explain the position, and the English, according to Joe Good's account, the English London soldiers who were there were not terribly impressed at the idea of giving up and were sort of more of a mind to fight to the death type of thing.
Right.
And he said that they were addressed by Pearse and Clark and McDermott, all of whom gave very heartfelt speeches, which went down very well. But he said they still were not convinced. And the man who convinced them was Sean McDermott.
Really?
And he said McDermott listened to them and then made a speech where he said, or looked at the practicality, he said, look, we the leaders are all going to be shot, but this has to go on,
Jesus,
and you're the guys who have to keep it on, so you have to stay alive. You're English, so they probably won't shoot you. They'll intern you for a while, which is in fact what happened.
Didn't they intern him?
They interned him, yeah. And so he actually describes, I think he says... Pearse was the heart of the, or Pearse was the soul of the rising. Connolly was its heart, but McDermott was its mind.
Goodness gracious!
And but anyway, he then describes when they surrendered, the British troops marched them through Dublin. And of course, as is well documented elsewhere, the crowds of Dubliners were very hostile to them,
I
because they
that.
Had, regarded them as fools, and they'd,
right, yeah.
you know, cause trouble in the city.
I suppose and the city
he says,
was a
in
mess
fact,
after,
they were protected by the British soldiers from some of the Irish civilians. There were shouts of bayonet them and kill them. And they said, God knows what would have happened if the Irish, some of the, particularly the Shawleys, as he described, the women had been let loose on them. So they're actually protected by the British soldiers. Then, of course, apart from the leaders, Pearson, Connolly and so on, who were shot, the rest were interned in Frongoch camp in Wales. But they were only there for a number of months, and most of them, in fact, they were.
Is that where Good went?
Yeah, that's where Good went, and he was there. They were all sent there, and in fact, it was a model. One of the things about internment camps is putting them all together was basically brought. Was maybe not a good idea in the end because it allowed them to
plan
the next move and so on. And Collins was, of course, in Frongoch, and Collins became very much the leader of the movement after the rising from, you know, when the War of Independence then started.
Came along, yeah.
And I mean, there's a few amusing bits in it where he describes how the doctor, the medical director of Frongoch camp, says that it's the first time he's had an army of 1,800 soldiers and not a single case of VD amongst them. And apparently one young soldier said, don't worry, I'll put that right as soon as I can. But he
1,800 of them, Michael?
There were about 1,800 in Frongoch. Now, they were only there for a number of months and then they came back to Dublin.
Right.
And then he describes events in the War of Independence. He particularly is a particular fan of Cathal Brua. He regards Cathal Brua very highly.
Right.
And in fact, at one stage, in 1918, when there's a threat of conscription in Ireland, Joe is dispatched along with a few other soldiers under the command of Cathal Brua. They're sent to London with the intention of assassinating members of the British cabinet.
Right.
It's not quite clear whether they're to assassinate them to prevent conscription or as a reprisal after it happens. But anyway, he's set down that they're all given particular targets who they have to follow around and be ready to shoot once the order comes. He's charged with following Andrew Bonar Law, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer and subsequently became Prime Minister briefly. Yeah. So he follows them around. You know, he describes following these people around with a revolver in your pocket, waiting for the order to shoot. Jeepers. Now, in fact, and once or twice they were told, yes, it's on, and then they're told, no, it's off again. And in the end, after a number of months apparently in London, the whole thing was called off and they were ever shot. And of course, conscription was never brought in for Ireland now, whether this had anything to do with it or not. God only
what
knows.
Year was that were sent over to London?
That was 1918. That was just towards the end of the war.
There was talk
of conscription there. Conscription had not been applied in Ireland in 1915 when it started in Britain. They hadn't, but there had been talk that it might be, and particularly in 1918 they were still talking that it might be, but eventually they decided not to implement it.
The quality of his rating was
what Bala particularly comments on it, and that he for a man who is not an author, not a journalist, not a writer, that he writes very well.
And he apparently was well-read. He was throwing
this thing, he's well-read. He gives quotes from various things. And in fact, when he died, his son, Morris, who writes an epilogue to it, and says that when Joe died at the age of 62 in 1967, they wrote to Yeats' daughter, I think, or wife, I can't remember which, to ask could they put a quote by Yeats on his tombstone, because he was he was very fond of quoting Yeats, and so they did. In fact, the only member of the family who was living in Dublin at the time of his death in 1967 decided that they would only have a private funeral. But there was such an outcry from people who knew him around the country, this is Morris's account, that there was a huge outcry from people who knew him around the country in County Kerry, people who'd fought with him and so on and so forth, that eventually he did get the full military funeral that 1916 veterans have got, you know, with the Irish flag on his coffin and so on. And he was brought to Bohornibrea in a cemetery and buried there with the full military honours. So he died, yeah, as I said, in 1967. He doesn't write about the Civil War. The book stops. He writes about the
War of Independence.
Yeah. And then he stops at the start of the Civil War. And apparently he just could not bring himself to write or to talk at any length about the Civil War. He felt that he was so horrified by
revulsed by that
that he just would not write about it. And as I said, he left the army and took no further active part in anything after the, you know, after the Civil War ended in 22-23.
Well, thanks very much for that, okay. Michael. That's Inside the GPO, a first-hand account, the memoirs of Joe Good, which were collected by his son Morris, and they're republished again by O'Brien Press. I think it's about $11.99 the price of it there in the paperback. So recommendation for a fresh look at the Rising.
Yeah, it's worth reading. Anybody who's interested in the Rising, I mean, as I said, it's you won't learn a huge amount that's new, other than sort of vignettes of things that happened in the GPO.
Thank you, Michael.
Online at near.ie and on air across northeast Dublin. 90.3, this is Near FM.
You're listening to Cover to Cover. I'm Joe Collins. During the week, I was visited Coolock Local Library to talk to the ladies there who had formed a book club, and I talked to them about what they're reading and what benefits the book club has for them. This morning I'm in Coolock Local Library as part of our ongoing library series, just seeing what sort of services and facilities are offered to the local community via their library. And I'm delighted to be in the reading stroke meeting room of the local book club that is run out of the library, and with the ladies here who have been reading a rather big book by Jodi Picoult, The Storyteller. I'm going to be talking to them a little bit about that in a moment. But first of all, I'd just like to talk to some of the ladies about their book club. Hello, Teresa. This is Teresa Slattery.
Hello.
How are you doing, Teresa?
Oh, grand, thank you.
Tell me, Teresa, how long is your book club going?
Well,
and when and who started it up?
Well, I tell you, we got a call about 10 years ago, wasn't it? And 10 years ago, from the librarian at the time, the chief librarian at the time here was Mary Dempsey.
Yes.
And she gave us a call, and book clubs were just starting to flourish around.
Had you connections, established connections with the library?
Oh, we had, because we had been in the, we had been part of Fingal Writers Group.
Oh, really?
Yes, we had. And we called it Fingal because at the time when the book club, or when the readers, the writers started,
yes,
we had people from Rush and everything here had wanted to join, so we took it in the whole area. But that ran for years, and then that just went its own way, you know, afterwards. And so Mary asked us to, Maura and myself, to meet this
woman. Maura's another member sitting beside me.
Yeah, Maura Carr and myself. And we met this woman called Phil Martin, and she had created, I think it was out in Baldoyle. I can't remember, but I think it was Baldoyle. She had started this group, just sort of, you know, asking people to the, you know, people who like to read.
Yes,
you know,
would they be interested? Would
be interested in forming a group?
Yeah.
So, and it spread like that, and then so Mary heard about it, and she got in touch with her, and she got in touch with us, and we came and met her, and she gave us the. There's not really rules. There's a form, it kind of thing. It lasts for an hour.
You just meet once a month, don't you?
We meet once a month on the first Thursday of the month.
And you select a book for the next month,
Yes, we do.
And what about the book you have just read? Do you use?
Sometimes the books that we select are not always the books we can get, you know, because of, you know. And I haven't had this month's book.
Right. I'll just have a word with Mary here. Sorry,
Maura.
Maura Carr, is it?
Carr.
Carr. Maura, you're one of the founding members of the club, aren't you?
I'm one of the
founding members with Teresa here. So you've been a member how long now?
I'd say roughly between 15 and 12, 10 years it's going.
That's quite a long period is, to have yes. a book club.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
Great. We've a great crowd of women.
Right.
About 12, 15 at times.
12 or 15 members.
Great, yeah.
Do you find you've met new people?
Loads, yes. And they've introduced me to new books, which I wouldn't have read.
Yeah. Right,
you know,
so
what they like, I wouldn't like. But when I started to read what they liked, I thought they were great.
That's a very interesting aspect of the book club. I'm just going to move on over here to another lady. Could you tell us your name, please?
I'm Breed Ford.
Breed Ford, yeah.
I'm comparatively new compared to Maura and Teresa.
Oh, you're a new member. How long are you a member?
I'm not new. I'm a few...
Well, relatively.
A few years, yeah.
Yeah, and why did you join the book club? If you don't mind me asking.
I'm not a huge... I wasn't a huge reader. But
yes.
I was interested in what went on and why people read and the different views on the different books.
Yeah.
It was very diverse.
So it's a mix of opinions and tastes
that you're
offered
yes.
and experience.
You would think that everybody would find a book very good.
Right.
And some people say not at all, no.
Right. I'm just moving on to another lady here. Excuse me, what's your name?
Pat Keegan.
Pat Keegan. And Pat, how long are you a member here of the book club?
About 10 years or more.
Right, so you're one of the stalwarts, you're one of the anchor ladies, would you say?
No, not really. I don't see myself like that, but I come every month.
Yeah. What's the benefits of the book club, do you think, to you?
Well, we have a good laugh, really, and we review books. It's mostly talk.
Yeah.
And but we're all interested in books, and we all throw our likes back and forth, you know. It's not only the one book that we're supposed to read for the month. If we have read other books during the month, we'll put it forward and discuss it.
Yeah. So we're getting a diversity of benefits to being a member of the book club. From different opinions on books you're reading to different types of books and a social aspect as well. Is that right? Yeah? Would you like to say a word?
No.
Okay, that was all. I'm just moving over to this lady. What's your name, please?
Am I?
What's your name, please?
Do I watch?
What's your name, please?
Oh, what's it? I'm not hearing it. Celia Bruin.
Celia, and are you a long time member of the book club, Celia?
I suppose as long as Pat, maybe about 7 or 8 years. Yeah, 9.
Do you like reading?
Oh, love reading.
You love reading. Yeah.
I just didn't read that because I was reading an equally thick one at the same time.
Does the coming together of the meeting of the book club serve a good social purpose for you? Or?
Well, it does for me. Yeah, I like it. I was, you know. Ringed around on my planner at home, you know, first Thursday of every month. Nothing must interfere.
That's very good.
Yeah.
That's very good.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, thank you, ladies. The book that the ladies have been reading at the moment, as I said earlier, it's the author's Jodi Picoult. It's called The Storyteller. And it's two main characters, Sage Singer and Joseph Weber. Is this a love story? What's the story about?
Well, it is.
Maura.
It is about a damaged person. She starts off the damaged person, a young person. Damaged, you know.
Emotionally, are we talking about?
Oh, both. Yeah, but emotionally everywhere, yeah.
Right.
So anyway, she meets up with somebody who reverts back in time, an old man. And it all intertwines in with her grandmother and... family who was in Auschwitz in the camps.
Is it a war-based?
It's war-based, yes.
Right.
Yes. And, but it does, it's great read.
Right.
But for me, they had kind of outer experience, let's put it this way. I could have done without these interjections of time before these people existed, you know what I mean?
Right.
I'd have to try and figure them out because I really couldn't understand them, and I said every page I came to them, I really it was an outer thing.
Did you find that confused story?
Yes. But the rest of the story was fine. Now, you only got that every so often. And but the book itself was a great read.
Yeah, it's quite a tombstone, isn't it? Is it?
Oh, great.
There's it's almost 500 pages. Have you read it?
I did. I read it and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
What was the story about you?
To me, you see, I felt the thread running through that was forgiveness. That's what I...
Right.
Yes, this man was wanting forgiveness, but you don't... That doesn't come into it until well into the book. She befriends this man.
This is Joseph Weber.
Yes, he's a very old man. And his secret... I don't think I'd be telling that.
No,
he was an SS man, belonged to,
the SS, the Nazi movement.
She befriended him and felt he could help her with her damaged emotions because she was Jewish.
But she didn't know
at the time that he was SS.
Oh my goodness. Is he able to help her?
He did. She befriended him and she... She was a friend until the end, but I don't know whether I'd be telling the book, the end of the book.
No, go ahead.
But the forgiveness part, I felt disappointed that she wasn't able to forgive him.
Right.
For this atrocities in the war.
Where did her emotional damage come from? Is that revealed or hinted at?
Yes, her whole family, and I've read other Holocaust books, and people come out of that damage.
Of course, they must.
So that was her thing.
Did you enjoy the book overall?
I did. Every time, yeah, I wanted to keep reading it till I found out the end of it. There was, like Maura said, some diversions into kind of a mythical or something. Mystically, but I was able to ignore that a bit.
Right. Is there anybody that didn't like the book? Anybody didn't like the book?
At the beginning, now, I felt.
Sorry, we're talking to
Mary Wade. It was a little bit. They were bringing things to this terrible place from people that has died. I thought it wasn't going to be good, but then it got good later on. They were bringing things to this terrible place, like.
They were attending therapy, yeah.
Their husbands were after dying.
Right.
That was at the beginning.
So the book seems to be dealing with people dealing with emotional crisis and trauma. Would I be right in saying that?
Yes, yeah.
About the writing style of the author.
Yes, I've no problem with her writing.
I'm talking to Maura again.
Yes, I've no problem with her writing. I always find it easy. Reading,
right?
Yeah, definitely.
Just this particular. You were saying earlier on that she sort of digressed into
supernatural or
prelogue
something.
Or whatever it was.
Yes,
and that sort of, you felt that took away from it, did you?
Oh, I did. Yeah.
Right.
Yes, but the rest of the story was fine.
Very good. So they seem to have liked this book, The Storyteller, by Jodi Picoult. I'm just going to talk to Teresa Slattery again. Teresa, how do you go about choosing a book for your reviews to read?
Well, what we do is most people think of a title, you know, some book that they particularly like to read or something, or just throw one into the pile, and we give a list into the
librarian,
and what books we can get, we do get, but we very seldom. We've learned the hard way not to look for new books that are just out on the thing, because there's about every book club that's around the country is looking for it.
After new editions, is it?
After, you know, these,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And so we know not to. But one of the other things that was very interesting for us in the start of the group was, you know, the Impact Awards?
Yes.
We used to get involved in that, because there's libraries all over the world that choose those books.
They're a community of themselves.
Yes, they are,
isn't it, really? Yeah.
And we used to go to the launches of the shortlist and the long list, you know.
Yes.
But because of funds and, you know, everything, that doesn't happen anymore, you know. But there was, so that was a good social outlet for... And also one of the things that and what Maura referred to it earlier, that we all, in the beginning, and even today, we still, we like books that translated from some, because it's nice to, it's very interesting to learn how other cultures live. Do you know?
Right, so you like to read English translations of foreign
authors.
Yes, we do.
Authors, we do indeed. Yes,
very good,
we do,
very good.
You know.
There's some great offerings at the moment too out there, by foreign authors.
Yeah.
There's some great material.
And the Impact Award itself is unique in that as far as I know, it's the only literary award in the world that gives a special prize to the translator.
Yes.
So, the whole thing is very interesting that way, you know.
And the translation.
And there's a big world out there. That we did learn more about over, especially in the early days of the writers of the readers group, you know.
Because translation from one language to another, it's a skill in itself, isn't it? To try and to move the story into another language and yet retain all the characteristics and qualities that it has, and it hasn't.
But so. I think anybody who reads, there's always this type of book that they particularly like to read, you know, a particular genre is this.
Yes,
the way
yes.
I get that word. I mean,
it's a bit overused.
It's a bit overused, right?
Yeah, of course.
But anyway, but I think that when you... and we all just stick to that. We do stick to what we like. But it's lovely. It's great to get a broadening of your literature, because I think most of us were reading since we were 9 or 10. I mean, reading is lovely. It's a great gift to give a child, you know. But I really do think that it's great to have a reader's group.
Well, thank you very much for that, Teresa. And thank you, ladies, for participating in this short interview. We will be coming back to the ladies, hopefully again, to feature them, giving some reviews of their books throughout the year. And so would you say, ladies, it's an overall success, The book club?
Yes, definitely.
There we go. That's the ladies of the Coolock Library Book Club. And thank you so very much for your participation. Our listeners will be delighted to listen to us and hear us. Thank you very much.
Online at near.ie and on air across northeast Dublin. 90.3. This is Near FM.
Still in Coolock Library, I'm joined by librarian Paul Daly. Hiya, Paul.
How are you doing?
And Paul, I've just been in with your book club there. They were telling me about how the library facilitates the attainment of books and gives them a room and tea-making facilities and all. And everyone was full of praise for the library. And I must admit, on my last visit to the library, I got a sort of a community feeling, a very homely feeling about Coolock Library. Is that part of the agenda from the management team to make it accessible to the community, to make it homely, inviting?
Well, absolutely. Well, it's really down to the staff and the relationship that the staff have with the community here. We've got a great staff here who are thoroughly helpful and try and treat everybody equally and help everybody out as best they can when they come in the door. So be that books, be that meeting rooms, be that needing information, be that an application form, we'll do our best for you.
Yeah, I actually was talking to one of the general members of the public out there, a regular gentleman, and that's what he did mention. He mentioned the staff and how helpful they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's funny that we, you know, over the years we've had regular staff here, and we've had great relationship with people who come in. We generally talk to them, we get to know them. Often many of them we know by name, and right down to the point where they, you know, they live their lives and they help, and we see them every so often, month on month, and then even to the point where they pass away. You know that.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, you know, we always have sad occasions where we see somebody or find out somebody who has left us, you know.
Yes, yes.
So I think there's...
Actually, just when you mentioned that, some of the book club members were talking about how beneficial the book club was during times of bereavement and that sort of stress. and how the reading and that helped them to deal with their grief and stuff like that, to deal with their trauma, you know.
Yeah, so. Well, I mean, the onus, I mean, the you ask about what the agenda here is. The agenda really is to help people and to care for people. That's ultimately how we see it, as certainly as a group, and the larger organisation, I hope, are aiming that way too. They're because it's a good community feel, people gather together. So we have situations like the book clubs, and we have the Community University Library on lectures on Thursday mornings. And those groups get together, and because they meet regularly, they gather friendships.
Bonds are formed,
and often cases they last a lifetime. For instance, we have the Community University now has been running for nearly 3 years.
Community University, you call it? Yes. Tell me. I the last day I was in here trying to arrange the interview, and the people were attending. It was Thursday morning, and people were attending it. Tell us a little bit about that Community University. I find it very interesting.
Yeah, it's a partnership between the Northside Partnership, Maynooth University, and Dublin City Council Public Libraries. It's an event that has been running in Kildare and has been running here, and it's still ongoing here. It's its third year and it's been running very well. What happens is, for about 20 weeks on a Thursday morning from 10 o'clock till about 12:30, there's a lecture on various topics. Lectures come from Maynooth University. They do topics such as economics, politics, geography, social history, genealogy. It depends on year to year what the programme is.
Is there courses developed specifically tailored for interest groups?
Yeah, I mean...
Or is there a certification at
there's
the
no
end?
Certification right. As yet. I mean, that's still one of the things in discussion. But
yes,
the real advantage of this course, it gives people a taster of university or third level education.
Yes.
Who may not have had the opportunity through, you know, for whatever reason, haven't had that opportunity. So on a Thursday morning, it's essentially for you know, 2 hours, where one corner of the library is a university.
That's right, yes, I've seen
that. So, creates great fizz here on a Thursday morning. There's always a great...
It's a great buzz, isn't there,
yeah. Particularly when, you know... The volume might rise a little bit here when they, you know, the.
Yes, it's not the quietest. It's not a noisy library, but people do communicate. I see that going on. Quietly.
Yeah, well, you see, people often ask, you know, does a library have to be quiet? And generally, it does. But however, we've so many different types of people and so many things going on, and the libraries tend to be more and more active in terms of events and exhibitions, and that. It isn't always as quiet as one would hope, but generally we try and facilitate everybody. So, I mean, if it's a case where people are studying and they're finding the noise a little bit difficult, we try and quell that noise, or we have meeting room facilities where we try and try and provide make the best for everybody.
Yeah.
But again, we're accommodating for large groups of people, and this is a very, very busy branch library.
Yes, it is indeed, and it's good size.
So we've a lot of people coming through. So, so again, it's a case of trying to cater for everybody.
But you mentioned events there. What sort of events or exhibitions might you have going on at your library of late, Paul?
Well, at the moment, there's an exhibition on 40 years of the Girl Guides.
Oh, that's interesting.
The Airtown Coolock Girl Guides, they've been going on. They had a launch here about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Where the place was full of Girl Guides.
My goodness.
And a very impressive lot too.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll invite them again. They tidied up after them.
Oh, goodness.
So that's going on. So again, we have launches. We have we've an art group here who meets here on a Thursday and Friday morning. They have an annual exhibition here as well.
Very good.
We facilitate them.
Is it the painting arts? Are we talking about drawing?
Painting. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. They're a good group now. They've gone for field trips from here to the library. You know, the bus will pull up outside. And
right.
they've gone into Parnell Street and places like that to go to galleries. So there's, again, back to the community feel. There's
a focus of community involvement. You know?
Yeah. So again, we're facilitating that and trying to encourage it.
How long have you been a librarian here, Paul?
Here in this library, I've been here two years.
2 years.
2 years. Well, I had a previous stint here a number of years back.
Right. Yeah.
But I had a sabbatical, so I'm back again.
In terms of obtaining books for the library, how are books selected when you're restocking, or what sort of a process do you go through when you just want to attain new books, or do you have a yearly budget to?
Yeah, well, the libraries would have an annual budget, and that budget would be divided centrally. So it's based on statistical analysis by the catalogers and the reader services,
right?
Who are based in headquarters in Cabra and Pier Street.
So it's more of a bureaucratic decision that.
Obviously a personal decision as well. I mean, if we do tend, because we get statistics, we ourselves in this library have to keep an eye on them. We do get listings from reader services on a monthly basis asking us what we think is needed here.
Right.
So we, based on statistical analysis, and then of course we have to take into account what people want on a regular basis.
Right. So how would you do that? How would you take into account your readers, your membership? How do you assess or survey their interests? Would you just have a process for that?
Well, there's a statistical process. We have to withdraw every number of books every so often in order to facilitate more books. And in that process, we can keep an eye on what's required. Also, you know, as time goes on, once we're good staff, we talk to one another. So, and in that process of talking to one another or impromptu meetings, we can assess, you know, what is current, what is required.
Yes, and I suppose, I mean, yes, you're always in contact with your members, so you're hearing.
Yeah.
You're hearing.
Well, I mean, the libraries generally are expanding as a network. So, the interesting thing is that once you get communities and large numbers of people coming into the library here, they're not only connected to this library, they're also now connected to the Dublin-wide libraries, and Dublin-wide libraries will all be connected very shortly, and in fact the computer systems are going to allow Ireland as a country in whole to be connected
so nationally.
All the libraries will be collected nationally eventually.
Okay, that's interesting progress. Yeah. You know, what sort of do you encounter specific problems in the running of the library on a daily basis, Paul? What about books not being returned? Is that still a difficulty for some libraries?
It is, but again, it's encouragement. I think one of the problems we encountered, or at least I encountered when I first here, is that there was an old school librarian,
yes,
who people feared, and so if somebody ran up with fines on their books, you know, oftentimes
they were afraid to face the music.
They were afraid to face it back.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And I would always say to people, "Is don't be afraid. We're not scary. Come in and talk to us. We understand people have situations.
Yeah.
We'll try and best cater for it and figure it out, because we don't want you not to use the library.
Of course.
Sometimes it's a case of helping people train themselves in order to bring the books back regularly. And if people come to the library regularly, you know, they don't need to think about it anymore.
Of course.
It becomes a matter of habit.
Future plans, Paul? Anything in the pipeline?
Well, for this particular library, the interesting thing is that we are getting a refurbishment within the next 3 years, which is starting.
Oh, very good.
Should be starting in the next couple of weeks. We're getting the roof replaced. We're getting new windows in.
General maintenance of your building.
We're trying to make the building more energy friendly and save costs on it.
Yes.
And hopefully, the internal money allowing, we will do some work on the inside, so we'll be getting new carpeting.
And, right.
Hopefully a little, and I like a paint, we might.
Tell me, has there been any talk about having an e-book sort of library? Or have the libraries considered how they might sort of support or set up such a facility? Were they attain e-books for maybe readers who are homebound or whatever, that they could access a database of that sort of material?
The homebound are less than likely to use the Kindles or whatnot. But that's purely anecdotal now.
Right.
Some of the library authorities, particularly South Dublin, have started pilot systems where you can download them from the internet.
Yes.
It hasn't been done here. It may be in the pipeline further along the road when we get the new computer systems up and running. But as yet, no, I think our interest is primarily in books as such. But I'm sure it will happen in time.
Right. Yeah. Paul Daly, a librarian at Coolock Local Library, thank you very much for giving me the time for this interview and talking about the many good and ongoing things and facilities you've got going here for your membership. Thank you, Paul.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Well, that was Paul Daly, a librarian at Coolock Library, telling us about all the facilities they have on offer there. And, I mean, your local library, we should all support our local library. It's a wonderful facility to have in our community. For by the books they offer, as you heard, they offer educational courses. They're a great focus point for people to meet in a relaxed social atmosphere, and even to expand your social horizons. They're a great starting point. There's wonderfully helpful staff who are only too delighted to assist anyone who may be new, you know, or a little bit anxious about going into the library, or, you know, any sort of formal inquiry sometimes can be a little bit daunting for the more shy among us. But do get into your local library. They've got lots on offer. It's a wonderful facility to have in your community. And get in there and use it. Coming up on the next show will be the eve of William Butler Yeats' 150th anniversary. He was born on the 13th of June 1865, and we'll be doing a special programme about him, but also I'll have a special recording made with the kids of North Bay Educate Together School, tell me all about their trip to Liberty Hall, and review the book by David O'Doherty, Dangers Everywhere, and that promises to be a bit of fun. Until then, I'd just like to thank Michael Sharp, our resident reviewer, for giving us that review. The ladies of Coolock Library Book Club, thank you very much, especially Theresa Slattery, for inviting me along and giving me the time to explain all what they do and talk about the benefits of the book club to them. And thanks again to Paul Daly for his contribution. My colleague Morgan O'Reilly will be up next week. He'll be no doubt giving details about Dublin International Literary Festival and other literary events. I'm sure he'll be wanting to talk about Mr. Yeats as well. From me, Joe Collins, at Near FM and 80.3, bringing you cover to cover, I'd just like to say goodbye, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.